he suddenly determined to go to Samsonov, the merchant who was Grushenka's protector, and to propose a scheme to him, and by means of it to obtain from him at once the whole of the sum required. Of the commercial value of his scheme he had no doubt, not the slightest, and was only uncertain how Samsonov would look upon his freak, supposing he were to consider it from any but the commercial point of view. Though Mitya knew the merchant by sight, he was not acquainted with him and had never spoken a word to him. But for some unknown reason he had long entertained the conviction that the old reprobate, who was lying at death's door, would perhaps not at all object now to Grushenka's securing a respectable position, and marrying a man to be depended upon. And he believed not only that he would not object, but that this was what he desired, and, if opportunity arose, that he would be ready to help. From some rumor, or perhaps from some stray word of Grushenka's, he had gathered further that the old man would perhaps prefer him to Fyodor Pavlovich for Grushenka. Possibly many of the readers of my novel will feel that in reckoning on such assistance, and being ready to take his bride, so to speak, from the hands of her protector, Dmitri showed great coarseness and want of delicacy. I will only observe that Mitya looked upon Grushenka's past as something completely over. He looked on that past with infinite pity and resolved with all the fervor of his passion that when once Grushenka told him she loved him and would marry him, it would mean the beginning of a new Grushenka and a new Dmitri, free from every vice. They would forgive one another and would begin their lives afresh. As for Kuzma Samsonov, Dmitri looked upon him as a man who had exercised a fateful influence in that remote past of Grushenka's, though she had never loved him, and who was now himself a thing of the past, completely done with, and, so to say, non-existent. Besides, Mitya hardly looked upon him as a man at all, for it was known to everyone in the town that he was only a shattered wreck, whose relations with Grushenka had changed their character and were now simply paternal, and that this had been so for a long time. In any case, there was much simplicity on Mitya's part in all this, for in spite of all his vices, he was a very simple, hearted man. It was an instance of this simplicity that Mitya was seriously persuaded that, being on the eve of his departure for the next world, old Kuzma must sincerely repent of his past relations with Grushenka, and that she had no more devoted friend and protector in the world than this, now harmless, old man. After his conversation with Alishaw, at the cross roads, he hardly slept all night, and at 10 o'clock next morning, he was at the house of Samsonov and telling the servant to announce him. It was a very large and gloomy old house of two stories, with a lodge and outhouses. In the lower story lived Samsonov's two married sons with their families, his old sister, and his unmarried daughter. In the lodge lived two of his clerks, one of whom also had a large family. Both the lodge and the lower story were overcrowded, but the old man kept the upper floor to himself, and would not even let the daughter live there with him, though she waited upon him, and in spite of her asthma was obliged at certain fixed hours, and at any time he might call her, to run upstairs to him from below. This upper floor contained a number of large rooms kept purely for show, furnished in the old-fashioned merchant style, with long monotonous rows of clumsy mahogany chairs along the walls, with glass chandeliers under shades, and gloomy mirrors on the walls. All these rooms were entirely empty and unused, for the old man kept to one room, a small, remote bedroom, where he was waited upon by an old servant with a kerchief on her head, and by a lad, who used to sit on the locker in the passage. Owing to his swollen legs, the old man could hardly walk at all, and was only rarely lifted from his leather armchair, when the old woman supporting him led him up and down the room once or twice. He was morose and taciturn even with this old woman. When he was informed of the arrival of the captain, he at once refused to see him. But Mitya persisted and sent his name up again. Samsonov questioned the lad minutely, what he looked like. Whether he was drunk? Was he going to make a row? The answer he received was, that he was sober, but wouldn't go away. The old man again refused to see him. Then Mitya, who had foreseen this, and purposely brought pencil and paper with him, wrote clearly on the piece of paper the words, "On most important business closely concerning Agrafena Alexandrovna," and sent it up to the old man. After thinking a little, Samsonov told the lad to take the visitor to the drawing room, and sent the old woman downstairs with a summons to his younger son to come upstairs to him at once. This younger son, a man over 6 foot and of exceptional physical strength, who was closely shaven and dressed in the European style, though his father still wore a kaftan and a beard, came at once without a comment. All the family trembled before the father. The old man had sent for this giant, not because he was afraid of the captain — he was by no means of a timorous temper — but in order to have a witness in case of any emergency. Supported by his son and the servant lad, he waddled at last into the drawing room. It may be assumed that he felt considerable curiosity. The drawing room in which Mitya was awaiting him was a vast, dreary room that laid a weight of depression on the heart. It had a double row of windows, a gallery, marbled walls, and three immense chandeliers with glass lusters covered with shades. Mitya was sitting on a little chair at the entrance, awaiting his fate with nervous impatience. When the old man appeared at the opposite door, 70 feet away, Mitya jumped up at once, and with his long, military stride walked to meet him. Mitya was well dressed, in a frock coat, buttoned up, with a round hat and black gloves in his hands, just as he had been 3 days before at the elders, at the family meeting with his father and brothers. The old man waited for him, standing dignified and unbending, and Mitya felt at once that he had looked him through and through as he advanced. Mitya was greatly impressed, too, with Samsonov's immensely swollen face. His lower lip, which had always been thick, hung down now, looking like a bun. He bowed to his guest in dignified silence, motioned him to a low chair by the sofa, and, leaning on his son's arm, he began lowering himself onto the sofa opposite, groaning painfully, so that Mitya, seeing his painful exertions, immediately felt remorseful and sensitively conscious of his insignificance in the presence of the dignified person he had ventured to disturb. "What is it you want of me, sir?" said the old man, deliberately, distinctly, severely, but courteously, when he was at last seated. Mitya started, leapt up, but sat down again. Then he began at once speaking with loud, nervous haste, gesticulating, and in a positive frenzy. He was unmistakably a man driven into a corner, on the brink of ruin, catching at the last straw, ready to sink if he failed. Old Samsonov probably grasped all this in an instant, though his face remained cold and immovable as a statue's. "Most honored sir, Kuzma Kuzmich, you have no doubt heard more than once of my disputes with my father, Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov, who robbed me of my inheritance from my mother. Seeing the whole town is gossiping about it. For here everyone's gossiping of what they shouldn't. And besides, it might have reached you through Grushenka. I beg your pardon, through Agrafena Alexandrovna. Agrafena Alexandrovna, the lady of whom I have the highest respect and esteem." So Mitya began, and broke down at the first sentence. We will not reproduce his speech word for word, but will only summarize the gist of it. 3 months ago, he said, he had of express intention — Mitya purposely used these words instead of intentionally — consulted a lawyer in the chief town of the province, a distinguished lawyer, Kuzma Kuzmich, Pavel Pavlovich Kornaplodov. You have perhaps heard of him? A man of vast intellect, the mind of a statesman. He knows you, too. Spoke of you in the highest terms. Mitya broke down again. But these breaks did not deter him. He leapt instantly over the gaps, and struggled on and on. This Kornaplodov, after questioning him minutely, and inspecting the documents he was able to bring him — Mitya alluded somewhat vaguely to these documents, and slurred over the subject with special haste — reported that they certainly might take proceedings concerning the village of Chemashenya, which ought, he said, to have come to him, Mitya, from his mother, and so checkmate the old villain, his father. Because every door was not closed and justice might still find a loophole. In fact, he might reckon on an additional sum of 6 or even 7,000 rubles from Fyodor Pavlovich, as Chemashenyev was worth, at least, 25,000. He might say 28,000, in fact, 30, Kuzma Kuzmich, and would you believe it, I didn't get 17 from that heartless man. So he, Mitya, had thrown the business up for the time, knowing nothing about the law, but on coming here was struck dumb by a cross, claim made upon him. Here Mitya went adrift again and again took a flying leap forward, so will not you, excellent and honored Kuzma Kuzmich, be willing to take up all my claims against that unnatural monster, and pay me a sum down of only 3,000? You see, you cannot, in any case, lose over it. On my honor, I swear that. Quite the contrary, you may make 6 or 7,000 instead of 3. Above all, he wanted this concluded that very day. I'll do the business with you at a notary's, or whatever it is. In fact, I'm ready to do anything. I'll hand over all the deeds. Whatever you want, sign anything. And we could draw up the agreement at once. And if it were possible, if it were only possible, that very morning. You could pay me that 3,000, for there isn't a capitalist in this town to compare with you, and so would save me from. Save me, in fact. For a good, I might say an honorable action. For I cherish the most honorable feelings for a certain person, whom you know well, and care for as a father. I would not have come, indeed, if it had not been as a father. And, indeed, it's a struggle of 3 in this business, for it's fate, that's a fearful thing, Kuzma Kuzmich. A tragedy, Kuzma Kuzmich, a tragedy. And as you've dropped out long ago, it's a tug, of, war between 2. I'm expressing it awkwardly, perhaps, but I'm not a literary man. You see, I'm on the one side, and that monster on the other. So you must choose. It's either I or the monster. It all lies in your hands. The fate of 3 lives, and the happiness of 2. Excuse me, I'm making a mess of it, but you understand. I see from your venerable eyes that you understand. And if you don't understand, I'm done for. So you see. Mitya broke off his clumsy speech with that, so you see. And jumping up from his seat, awaited the answer to his foolish proposal. At the last phrase he had suddenly become hopelessly aware that it had all fallen flat, above all, that he had been talking utter nonsense. How strange it is. On the way here it seemed all right, and now it's nothing but nonsense. The idea suddenly dawned on his despairing mind. All the while he had been talking, the old man sat motionless, watching him with an icy expression in his eyes. After keeping him for a moment in suspense, Kuzma Kuzmich pronounced at last in the most positive and chilling tone, "Excuse me, we don't undertake such business." Mitya suddenly felt his legs growing weak under him. "What am I to do now, Kuzma Kuzmich?" he muttered, with a pale smile. "I suppose it's all up with me, what do you think?" "Excuse me." Mitya remained standing, staring motionless. He suddenly noticed a movement in the old man's face. He started. "You see, sir, business of that sort's not in our line," said the old man slowly. "There's the court, and the lawyers, it's a perfect misery. But if you like, there is a man here you might apply to." "Good heavens! Who is it?" "You're my salvation, Kuzma Kuzmich," faltered Mitya. "He doesn't live here, and he's not here just now. He is a peasant, he does business in timber. His name is Lyagavy. He's been haggling with Fyodor Pavlovich for the last year, over your copse at Chemashnya. They can't agree on the price, maybe you've heard? Now he's come back again and is staying with the priest at Ilinsku, about 12 versts from the Volovia station. He wrote to me, too, about the business of the copse, asking my advice. Fyodor Pavlovich means to go and see him himself. So if you were to be beforehand with Fyodor Pavlovich and to make Lyagavy the offer you've made me, he might possibly—" "A brilliant idea," Mitya interrupted ecstatically. "He's the very man, it would just suit him. He's haggling with him for it, being asked too much, and here he would have all the documents entitling him to the property itself. Ha ha ha. And Mitya suddenly went off into his short, wooden laugh, startling Samson off. How can I thank you, Kuzmich? Cried Mitya effusively. Don't mention it, said Samsonov, inclining his head. But you don't know, you've saved me. Oh, it was a true presentiment brought me to you. So now to this priest. No need of thanks. I'll make haste and fly there. I'm afraid I've overtaxed your strength. I shall never forget it. It's a Russian says that, Kuzmich, Russian. To be sure. Mitya seized his hand to press it, but there was a malignant gleam in the old man's eye. Mitya drew back his hand, but at once blamed himself for his mistrustfulness. It's because he's tired, he thought. For her sake? For her sake, Kuzmich. You understand that it's for her, he cried, his voice ringing through the room. He bowed, turned sharply round, and with the same long stride walked to the door without looking back. He was trembling with delight. Everything was on the verge of ruin and my guardian angel saved me, was the thought in his mind. And if such a businessman as Samsonov, a most worthy old man, and what dignity, had suggested this course, then success was assured. He would fly off immediately. I will be back before night, I shall be back at night and the thing is done. Could the old man have been laughing at me? Exclaimed Mitya, as he strode towards his lodging. He could, of course, imagine nothing but that the advice was practical from such a businessman with an understanding of the business, with an understanding of this Lyagavy, curious surname. Or, the old man was laughing at him. Alas! The second alternative was the correct one. Long afterwards, when the catastrophe had happened, old Samsonov himself confessed, laughing, that he had made a fool of the captain. He was a cold, spiteful and sarcastic man, liable to violent antipathies. Whether it was the captain's excited face, or the foolish conviction of the rake and spendthrift, that he, Samsonov, could be taken in by such a cock, and, bull story as his scheme, or his jealousy of Grushenka, in whose name this scapegrace had rushed in on him with such a tale to get money which worked on the old man, I can't tell. But at the instant when Mitya stood before him, feeling his legs grow weak under him, and frantically exclaiming that he was ruined, at that moment the old man looked at him with intense spite, and resolved to make a laughing stock of him. When Mitya had gone, Kuzmich, white with rage, turned to his son and bade him see to it that that beggar be never seen again, and never admitted even into the yard, or else he did not utter his threat. But even his son, who often saw him enraged, trembled with fear. For a whole hour afterwards, the old man was shaking with anger, and by evening he was worse, and sent for the doctor. Chapter 2, Lyagavy. So he must drive at full speed, and he had not the money for horses. He had 40 kopecks, and that was all that was left after so many years of prosperity. But he had at home an old silver watch which had long ceased to go. He snatched it up and carried it to a Jewish watchmaker who had a shop in the market place. The Jew gave him 6 rubles for it. And I didn't expect that, cried Mitya, ecstatically. He was still in a state of ecstasy. He seized his 6 rubles and ran home. At home he borrowed 3 rubles from the people of the house, who loved him so much that they were pleased to give it him, though it was all they had. Mitya in his excitement told them on the spot that his fate would be decided that day, and he described, in desperate haste, the whole scheme he had put before Samsonov, for these people had been told many of their lodgers' secrets before, and so looked upon him as a gentleman who was not at all proud, and almost one of themselves. Having thus collected 9 rubles, Mitya sent for posting horses to take him to the Volovya station. This was how the fact came to be remembered and established that at midday, on the day before the event, Mitya had not a farthing, and that he had sold his watch to get money and had borrowed 3 rubles from his landlord, all in the presence of witnesses. I note this fact, Later on it will be apparent why I do so. Though he was radiant with the joyful anticipation that he would at last solve all his difficulties, yet, as he drew near Volovya station, he trembled at the thought of what Grushenka might be doing in his absence. What if she made up her mind to date go to Fyodor Pavlovich? This was why he had gone off without telling her and why he left orders with his landlady not to let out where he had gone, if anyone came to inquire for him. I must get back to night, he repeated, as he was jolted along in the cart, and I dare say I shall have to bring this Lyagavy back here to draw up the deed. So mused Mitya, with a throbbing heart, but alas! His dreams were not fated to be carried out. To begin with, he was late, taking a short cut from Volovya station which turned out to be 18 versts instead of 12. Secondly, he did not find the priest at home at Ilinsku, he had gone off to a neighboring village. While Mitya, setting off though with the same exhausted horses, was looking for him, it was almost dark. The priest, a shy and amiable-looking little man, informed him at once that though Lyagavy had been staying with him at first, he was now at Sahoy Posyolok, that he was staying the night in the forester's cottage, as he was buying timber the two. At Mitya's urgent request that he would take him to Lyagavy at once, and by so doing save him, so to speak, the priest agreed, after some demur, to conduct him to Sahoy Posyolok. His curiosity was obviously aroused. But, unluckily, he advised their going on foot, as it would not be much over-reversed. Mitya, of course, agreed, and marched off with his yard, long strides, so that the poor priest almost ran after him. He was a very cautious man, though not old. Mitya at once began talking to him, too, of his plans, nervously and excitedly asking advice in regard to Lyagavy, and talking all the way. The priest listened attentively, but gave little advice. He turned off Mitya's questions with, I don't know. Ah, I can't say. How can I tell? And so on. When Mitya began to speak of his quarrel with his father over his inheritance, the priest was positively alarmed, as he was in some way dependent on Fyodor Pavlovich. He inquired, however, with surprise, why he called the peasant, traitor Gorstkin, Lyagavy, and obligingly explained to Mitya that, though the man's name really was Lyagavy, he was never called so, as he would be grievously offended at the name, and that he must be sure to call him Gorstkin, or you'll do nothing with him, he won't even listen to you, said the priest in conclusion. Mitya was somewhat surprised for a moment, and explained that that was what Samsonov had called him. On hearing this fact, the priest dropped the subject, though he would have done well to put into words his doubt whether, if Samsonov had sent him to that peasant, calling him Lyagavy, there was not something wrong about it and he was turning him into ridicule. But Mitya had no time to pause over such trifles. He hurried, striding along, and only when he reached Sahoy Posyolok did he realize that they had come not one verst, nor one and a half, but at least three. This annoyed him, but he controlled himself. They went into the hut. The forester lived in one half of the hut, and Gorstkin was lodging in the other, the better room the other side of the passage. They went into that room and lighted a tallow candle. The hut was extremely overheated. On the table there was a samovar that had gone out, a tray with cups, an empty rum bottle, a bottle of vodka partly full, and some half-eaten crusts of wheaten bread. The visitor himself lay stretched at full length on the bench, with his coat crushed up under his head for a pillow, snoring heavily. Mitya stood in perplexity. Of course, I must wake him. My business is too important. I've come in such haste. I'm in a hurry to get back to day, he said in great agitation. But the priest and the forester stood in silence, not giving their opinion. Mitya went up and began trying to wake him himself. He tried vigorously, but the sleeper did not wake. He's drunk, Mitya decided. Good Lord! What am I to do? What am I to do? And, terribly impatient, he began pulling him by the arms, by the legs, shaking his head, lifting him up and making him sit on the bench. Yet, after prolonged exertions, he could only succeed in getting the drunken man to utter absurd grunts, and violent, but inarticulate oaths. "No, you'd better wait a little," the priest pronounced at last, "for he's obviously not in a fit state. He's been drinking the whole day," the forester chimed in. "Good heavens!" cried Mitya. "If only you knew how important it is to me and how desperate I am." "No, you'd better wait till morning," the priest repeated. "Till morning? Mercy! That's impossible." And in his despair he was on the point of attacking the sleeping man again, but stopped short at once, realizing the uselessness of his efforts. The priest said nothing. The sleepy forester looked gloomy. "What terrible tragedies real life contrives for people," said Mitya, in complete despair. The perspiration was streaming down his face. The priest seized the moment to put before him, very reasonably, that, even if he succeeded in wakening the man, he would still be drunk and incapable of conversation. "And your business is important," he said, "so you'd certainly better put it off till morning." With a gesture of despair, Mitya agreed. "Father, I will stay here with a light, and seize the favorable moment. As soon as he wakes, I'll begin." "I'll pay you for the light," he said to the forester, "for the night's lodging, too. You'll remember Dmitri Karamazov." "Only, father, I don't know what we're to do with you. Where will you sleep?" "No, I'm going home. I'll take his horse and get home," he said, indicating the forester. "And now I'll say goodbye. I wish you all success." So it was settled. The priest rode off on the forester's horse, delighted to escape, though he shook his head uneasily, wondering whether he ought not next day to inform his benefactor Fyodor Pavlovich of this curious incident, or he may in an unlucky hour hear of it, be angry, and withdraw his favor. The forester, scratching himself, went back to his room without a word, and Mitya sat on the bench to catch the favorable moment, as he expressed it. Profound dejection clung about his soul like a heavy mist. A profound, intense dejection. He sat thinking, but could reach no conclusion. The candle burned dimly, a cricket chirped, it became insufferably close in the overheated room. He suddenly pictured the garden, the path behind the garden, the door of his father's house mysteriously opening and Grushenka running in. He leapt up from the bench. "It's a tragedy," he said, grinding his teeth. Mechanically he went up to the sleeping man and looked in his face. He was a lean, middle-aged peasant, with a very long face, flaxen curls, and a long, thin, reddish beard, wearing a blue cotton shirt and a black waistcoat, from the pocket of which peeped the chain of a silver watch. Mitya looked at his face with intense hatred, and for some unknown reason his curly hair particularly irritated him. What was insufferably humiliating was that, after leaving things of such importance and making such sacrifices, he, Mitya, utterly worn out, should with business of such urgency be standing over this dolt on whom his whole fate depended, while he snored as though there were nothing the matter, as though he dropped from another planet. "Oh, the irony of fate!" cried Mitya, and, quite losing his head, he fell again to rousing the tipsy peasant. He roused him with a sort of ferocity, pulled at him, pushed him, even beat him, but after 5 minutes of vain exertions, he returned to his bench in helpless despair, and sat down. "Stupid! Stupid!" cried Mitya. "And how dishonorable it all is!" Something made him mad. His head began to ache horribly. Should he fling it up and go away altogether? He wondered. "No, wait till tomorrow now. I'll stay on purpose. What else did I come for? Besides, I've no means of going. How am I to get away from here now?" Oh, the idiocy of it, but his head ached more and more. He sat without moving, and unconsciously dozed off and fell asleep as he sat. He seemed to have slept for 2 hours or more. He was waked up by his head aching so unbearably that he could have screamed. There was a hammering in his temples, and the top of his head ached. It was a long time before he could wake up fully and understand what had happened to him. At last he realized that the room was full of charcoal fumes from the stove, and that he might die of suffocation. And the drunken peasant still lay snoring. The candle guttered and was about to go out.